Chapter 20. Caris took the spy following her on a merry chase through the worst neighbourhoods of Big Jasper. She'd walked through the poverty a thousand times and never felt nervous, but today was different. Without the aegis of her blackguard garb, she felt oddly vulnerable. She didn't like it. In fact, she hated it. She nodded to shopkeepers she'd known for a dozen years, and they barely responded. They didn't even recognise her when she was wearing a thobe. Worse, their heavy-browed sons didn't either. She could beat any five of them, of course, depending. But the skirts of a thobe were too easy to snag, and her own experience with getting beaten in that alley not 2 months ago was too fresh for her to be haughty. She felt a stab of that same feeling of helplessness she'd spent her whole life fleeing. Someone whistled at her. Her fists clenched. Damn it, all her instincts were wrong here. It was like the world had changed and no one had bothered to tell her, all because she was wearing a thobe. Going and punching the whistler in the face wasn't going to get the same cowed reaction that it would have when she was wearing her blackguard garb. Neighbourhoods that should have been dangerous for her prey were instead dangerous for her. It felt like a failure when she put on her green spectacles to let them know she was a drafter. Thank Orholm she had that, at least. At a single disapproving raised eyebrow above those spectacles, the men gathering blanched and dispersed. It made her wonder. Other women dealt with this kind of thing every day, without bloodshed, without incident, and without a drafter's spectacles. Caris literally didn't know how they did it. She wondered if that didn't make her weaker, somehow, in her strength. Another woman would have defused the situation before it became a situation. Caris only knew how to intimidate, to evince superior power, one way or another. She'd had drafting for so long she wasn't sure how she would deal with life if she didn't have it. Humbling thought. And now she didn't have drafting. Not really. She could wear the spectacles, but if she drafted, the white would know. Even if she didn't know, if she asked, would Caris lie to her? No, not to the white. She was still being followed. She took off the spectacles and walked straight until she found the alley she'd been waiting for, long, without any other entrances, nor other alleys running parallel to it. If she were to be followed at all, her tail would have to follow down this alley. She stepped into the weaver's shop on the alley corner. "Scarves?" she asked. "Silk, if possible. I'm a wedding guest." She smiled blandly, and the delighted woman disappeared into the back of the shop, as Caris knew she would, leaving her undisturbed. Caris put a dinar on the counter to pay for the deceit and the ambush place, and hid among the free-flowing bolts of cloth hanging from the ceiling. Her tail passed the doorway blithely. Caris was on top of him in a moment, sidekick, left foot behind her right, power gathered in her hips, and right foot shooting out sideways into the man's passing shoulder with the force of a horse's kick. Petite as she was, it didn't matter with all her power applied so perfectly. The man shot up to his tiptoes and was thrown sideways. He hit the wall of the alley 3 paces away with a crunch. Before he could even crumple all the way to the ground, Caris was on top of him, fingers locked around his windpipe, pinning him to the wall, fist drawn back. The man was caught in an awkward half-crouch. He groaned. He'd been wearing a hat, and now it lay at his feet. He was perhaps 40, greasy, had sun dark skin, a messy semblance of an Atassian's beaded beard. He grunted.
"Told me you might hit me. Thought to myself, little woman like that, how hard can she hit?"
"Who sent you?" Caris asked.
"He's too careful for that girl. He told me to tell you this could have been another rough lesson like the last time. This is mercy."
"What? Another lesson?"
"When you got beat to hell. And I didn't have anything to do with that, so don't take it out on me. Hey, you mind letting me sit down or stand up?"
Caris let the man go.
"My thanks."
He looked at her, and blanched.
"Nine hells. You're the white blackguard, aren't you? The girl changes her hair. That bastard. Sending me after you. You didn't even draft.
Tell me something that convinces me not to hurt you."
"Fine, hell with him. Didn't pay me that much. He told me to string you out, make this take as long as possible. He didn't even set up a time for me to meet up with him again and tell him what I'd learned. You got somewhere else you're supposed to be?"
Caris didn't think so. But she didn't let the man's words distract her. He could be talking so that his friends could take her unawares. But there was no one else in the alley.
"What's your name?"
she asked. He grimaced, gave up.
Dayan Dakhan.
You owe me, Dayan Dakhan.
Ah, balls.
If whoever had hired him wanted this to take as long as possible, she needed to reclaim as much time as she could. She ran, arriving back at the Chromeria, sweating in a very unladylike fashion. She'd considered hiring a horse, but figured it would have actually been slower. Not all streets were open to riders, and with the time it would take to hire a horse in the first place, running was faster, even awkward as it was in a thobe. She hopped into the lift and took it as high as she could.
News?
She asked the blackguards at the top of the lift. One was the new boy, Gil Grayling. The other was the tall eunuch, Lytos. They looked at each other. Neither said anything.
Where's your escort? Lytos asked.
Dismissing Samite after going to the crossroads might not have been the best idea, but she wasn't going to talk to Lytos about that.
Gil, you owe me, she said, and this won't even be close to setting us even.
He sighed. He clearly would have preferred to forget letting that strumpet into Gavin's room. He cleared his throat and said,
There's an emergency meeting of the Spectrum. We're supposed to start an hour ago, but Yellow and Sub-Red couldn't make it then. They're just getting started.
Lytos looked at the young man.
What?
Gil asked.
She's one of us.
Lytos glowered at him.
What?
Thank you, you're both lovely, Karis said.
She ducked into Gavin's room. It was still too strange to think of it as her own room, and tried to decide if she needed to change, or if she could just use some powder to combat the sweat. She looked around for Mauricia. For a room slave, the woman didn't spend much time in her room. Now I want Mauricia to be here. Not very consistent, are we, Karis? She mopped her face with a cloth and then slapped powder on quickly, fought with her hair for half a minute and decided history belongs to those who show up. She headed to the lift.
Wow, that was quick. You look
Gil started to say.
Not a word, boy. Not a word.
Had she really just called a 19-year-old a boy? She approached the Spectrum's chamber and the blackguards standing outside it and suddenly wished she looked a little more glamorous.
Lady Guile, the ranking blackguard said.
It was her old counterpart.
Watch Captain Blademan. Good afternoon.
The Spectrum meetings are only for the Spectrum, Karis. You know that, he said, stepping in front of the door.
I'm my husband's representative here.
It was weak, and they both knew it.
Karis, please, don't make a scene.
It's Lady Guile, thank you, and a lady doesn't make a scene.
Watch Captain Blademan was befuddled for a moment, and a moment was all Karis needed to thread her petite figure past him and open the door.
Lady,
he stopped abruptly, as the door swung open and Karis walked inside. She walked over to Gavin's seat as insouciantly as if she herself were Gavin Guile. She sat. She didn't see how the rest of the Spectrum took her appearance because all of her attention was on Andros Guile. He smiled behind his dark spectacles. The bastard. He didn't even look surprised. For a moment it shook Karis's belief that the man who tailed her must have been sent by him, but if not Andros, then who?
Hello, daughter. So good of you to join us,
Andros said. His shadow, Grin Woody, was standing at his elbow as always, whispering in his ear.
I suppose that more than makes a quorum. Shall we get started?
Karis knew they hadn't just started, but Andros liked to deadpan his jabs. It might not even have been aimed at her. She looked around the room and saw that only the Sub-Red was absent. The woman was serially pregnant and usually nursing one of her brood, but she didn't usually let either get in the way of her duties.
We can continue from where we were, Andros, the White announced.
So it had been a jab. Well, to hell with him. Karis was here now. It was a victory, if a small one.
For reasons we discussed before all the hangers-on were allowed into this hallowed chamber,
Andros said,
certain more drastic moves must wait. Our representatives are scouring the seas and the beaches as we speak. Until then, we have to play the hand dealt us, yes?
Karis had no idea what he was talking about, but she could see tight-lit nods among the colours at the table. If they'd been talking just a few minutes ago even more privately than this, it must be something very secret. He'd said, hangers-on, plural.
That meant that he wasn't just talking about Karis coming into the room. The Spectrum must have been meeting without slaves in attendance, even without the Blackguard. What was so secret that the Blackguard wasn't allowed to attend? From the White's expression, Karis could see that the woman didn't like such secrets referred to, even this obliquely.
"In the meantime, we're at war."
Clytos Blue shifted in his seat, like he wanted to speak out, but daren't, not against Andros Gyle. But Andros Gyle flared with anger.
"You deny it, Clytos? Still? How many of our ships must they sink? How many of our people must they kill? We face nothing less than the old gods and those heretics who would bring them back. We will have little respite this winter, but it is a respite that will help our enemies more. Few ships can traverse the Cerulean Sea in winter's storms, and our enemies are on foot. We will have only those few Hrothgari soldiers and the remnants of the Atashian forces under that idiot General Azmuth."
"That's my cousin,"
Delara Orange said. Her face was slack, flushed, eyes bloodshot.
"Then you've one idiot in your family, or is it two?"
Andros shot back. She huffed and fell silent. It was an acquiescence, though, and Karis thought that if Delara admitted her cousin was stupid so easily, then Andros might actually be understating the case.
"You need to get word to him,"
Andros said,
"that he is to fight delaying actions only. Under no circumstances is he to risk a large-scale conflict."
"Have we not sent these orders already?"
the White asked.
"We have."
Andros didn't elaborate, and for Karis he didn't need to. She had seen how men intent on glory could get others killed. And Andros didn't like giving an order when he had not the means to enforce its obedience.
"Delaying actions?"
the White asked.
"How much ground are we to give?"
Andros sighed.
"We will need to marshal our forces for the spring. Realistically, we won't be able to stop them from advancing into Blood Forest."
"There are border towns. Oxford, Stony Field, Tanner's Turn, Mangrove Point. Are you proposing we just let them die?"
the Orange asked quietly, horrified.
"How do you propose we save them?"
Andros asked.
"Do you know of good options? Please, elucidate."
I just can't believe—
"We tell the people to get out. Burn it all. Starve the Colour Prince's army as it invades. Satrap Willowbough won't like it, but if they won't, we have to look at the possibility that we'll lose Blood Forest."
"You want them to burn jungles? In the wet season?"
the Orange asked.
"I want them to win this war in one decisive conflict, with no losses on our side. I want none innocent to suffer." "You're asking what I want? Don't be fooled. We need to win, so we need the Blood Foresters to poison wells. We need them to slaughter animals. We need them to torch their fields and cut down swaths of jungle and force every last one of their red drafters to break the halo if necessary to put it to flame. We need them to win so that 9 months from now we aren't talking about what villages we'll have to abandon in Hrothgar."
He let that sit and no one said anything.
"In the interim, we've lost the bulk of our fleet. We could begin to build and borrow a new one, but I propose that we don't even need to do that. We only need these new sea chariots that the Blackguards have developed."
"That Gavin invented," Karis said.
"Yes, of course. The Blackguards merely perfected them. Whatsoever you please, dear."
She sat back, stung.
How did the bastard do that? Make her look so small?
Andros continued.
"With the sea chariots, we can control the seas without the cost of an entire fleet. We know this Colour Prince has been working with Elysian pirates, and this way we can keep him from being resupplied by sea."
This Colour Prince. My brother.
"We can save specific tactical discussions for later," the White interjected.
"Fair," the Red said. "But this we can agree on. Our last battle was a disaster. We can't direct a war from afar. We're going to need a Promarchos."
Delara Orange laughed aloud.
"And you did such a good job directing our last battle, we should choose you, huh?"
Andros snapped back without the least pause.
You're a disgrace who couldn't even hold her satrapy against a petty raider from Tyria. You allowed this to blossom from a small problem to a huge one. Your defense was so heinously weak, I wonder if we aren't in the presence of a traitor. I never had functional command over those incompetents who insisted on being our generals, unlike the commander Promarchos would have, so check your memory. Maybe it's in the bottom of a bottle.
You stopped us from defending ourselves, Delara shouted. You refused to help. You came too late and you knew it. You want us to make you Promarchos? Enough, the White said.
I wasn't talking about me, Andros said. I'm too old. That burden is too great, and—
I've lost everyone. Delara shouted. Enough, the White barked. Delara, you have our sympathies, and you still have our vote, which you will lose if you're not present to use it. Do not give that up. What is it you propose, Hylux Lord Guile?
I'm too old? The old spider was admitting that? Carius could scarcely believe it. Who would he be proposing instead?
You all know that I had my disagreements with my son at times, but none of us can deny the unifying effect he had on the seven satrapies. He was a figurehead, but he was a well-loved one. In losing him, we have lost one of the most important bonds that holds these disparate satrapies together. For reasons that we should all know all too well, there will be—
He paused, passing his words carefully.
Unless Orholm relents, it appears there will be no new prism this Sunday. But by ancient law, we must name a prism elect. So we must all be on the lookout for Orholm's chosen. I'm sure we will all spend much time in prayer. We will have to survive as best we can for a year without one. That means the old orders, every drafter working together and offsetting those who have joined the enemy.
Carys looked around the table and saw drawn, grey faces everywhere.
You're not giving up on Gavin, she said. He's not dead. You should be focusing your efforts on finding him.
Of course we will,
Andros said smoothly. He smiled apologetically, as if dealing with a hysterical woman who couldn't bear to acknowledge her husband's obvious death.
This is merely contingency planning.
Carys wanted to punch his face in.
Why can't we name a new prism?
Aris Subred asked. Carys saw that at least a couple of the newer colours wondered the same, but Andros said immediately,
This is not a matter for an open meeting.
You're calling this an open meeting? Only the colours themselves and the High Magisterium may discuss these matters,
the White said, clearly not happy to concur, but doing so.
And not the one without the other.
Carys's jaw clenched. Andros was angling for something, and she couldn't see what it was. Andros continued.
We have worked together before through such trials, and we can do so again. We shall do so again. Regardless, our needs, our war, and our peoples cannot wait until even Sunday to find unity. We must face two painful truths before we lose everything. My son is dead, and we need a Promarchos.
He's not dead, Carys said.
Daughter, it speaks well of your loyalty and your love that you hope against hope as you do, but prudence demands a harsher reckoning with truth. Gavin is
alive,
a voice interrupted from the door.
He's been taken captain by an Elysian pirate named Gunnar.
Everyone stopped talking at once. Carys caught a faint glimpse of Mauricia as the door closed behind Kip, who had just spoken.
Kip?
Kip was alive?
And Gavin?
Carys's heart surged. She felt tingles all the way down her arms. It was hope. Real hope, not stubbornness. In the weeks since the battle, Kip had changed. For one thing, he must have been starved because he now looked merely thick instead of fat. He looked a guile. Strong chin, blue eyes bright with intelligence, ringed with green from drafting, broad shoulders, broad chest, thick though still shapeless arms. But the biggest change was in Kip's demeanour. There was nothing flippant or sarcastic or jokey about him, not in this moment. He was focused, quiet, unimpressed by this collection of the most powerful people in the world.
So the bastard returns,
Andros Guile said. Enough of that nonsense, Grandfather, Kip said. My father established what I am once and for all.
He look at me, Grandfather,
Kip snapped. I am Guile. Body, blood, and will. Deny it, if you dare, his attitude added. The very air seemed to vibrate with attention as the men locked gazes. No one said a word. Even Kip's dagger of a sentence wasn't a boy's complaint. He hadn't said, I'm a Guile. He'd said, I am Guile, as if he summed up everything that it was to be part of that family. As if he were the culmination of it, which was true in some ways, Caris supposed. He was the only Guile heir. The only heir they knew about. There was still a Guile bastard out there they didn't know existed, must never know. Her stomach knotted up. The blackguards standing outside guarding the room looked uncertain. Blackguards never looked uncertain. The air changed. Caris couldn't tell how she knew, but she knew that Andros had been convinced. Now he was holding the moment purely to buy time, or perhaps for his own perverse amusement. But Caris thought the former. He hadn't planned for Kip to return. He was turning cards in his brain, 3 rounds ahead of everyone else. Finally, a hint of a smile touched his lips. He made a slight gesture of acquiescence.
Please share this news with us, grandson.
What did Grinwoody tell you happened? On the ship, I mean. After all, you were wearing those spectacles, and it was dark. What was Kip doing? Why did he care what Grinwoody had said? Why offer the cover to Andros Guile, his enemy? Caris's stomach sank. Kip was offering an out to the old spider, offering to help him cover up. Cover up what? There would be no cover up necessary if Andros Guile hadn't done something wrong. That meant he was at fault for Gavin's disappearance. Or Holland damn him.
I don't think you telling us the truth should require any rehearsals of what others have said,
Andros Guile said, not accepting the olive branch. Kip shrugged. Grinwoody and I were quarrelling. I'd come along with my father, whom you'd summoned to meet with you. Grinwoody didn't want me to be there. I'm sure he believed you didn't want me to be there. He, a slave, laid hands on me, so I pushed him down the steps. Uncouth of me, and I apologize for it, Grandfather. I shouldn't manhandle your property so. With the strains of the battle of that day. Regardless, he ran back toward us. And Kip hesitated. Grinwoody's eyes looked dead. The slave couldn't even speak for himself. He knew that when millstones like the Guiles came together, even the most trusted slave might be sacrificed without a thought, ground to meal in an instant if Andros thought that he might gain something by sacrificing him. And he stumbled into me. I stumbled into my father. There was some scrambling as we all tried to save him from falling overboard, but he fell in the water. I jumped after him. I know Grinwoody doesn't swim, so though he offered, it would have been pointless. It was my father's own fault that he dismissed his blackguards, insisted on them going to bed. Otherwise, he might have been saved easily. Instead, I pulled my father out of the water and tried to light a signal. But instead of being saved by you, we were pulled out by Captain Gunner. He said some prayers to the sea and threw me back in afterward.
But you saw that my son was alive?
Andros was intense. Seemingly, honestly disbelieving.
Yes, sir. I'm certain of it. I'm surprised you haven't gotten ransom demands. Gunner recognized the prism, sir.
The white nodded.
Gavin has mentioned this pirate before. Said he's quite a character, but not quite sailing with a full crew. Mentally, as it were.
Grinwoody!
Andros barked, turning around in his seat.
I thought you said the prism was unconscious when he plunged into the waves.
Grinwoody fell prostrate.
My lord, mercy. I thought he'd hit his head on the way down. I believed he had already sank before the boy went after him. My lord master, I'm so sorry. I have shamed myself and you.
A silence. Cards turning.
No,
Andros said.
The shame is mine. I should never have given up on my son. In this year, when I have lost so much.
He trailed off as if overwhelmed with emotion, Then he put his hand to his heart and made the sign of the four and the three.
Orholm be praised!
He actually sounded sincere. Perhaps the old man really did love Gavin in his own way. The words were echoed around the table. Andros continued before anyone could interject.
I should never have taken a slave's word on something so important. I'll punish him appropriately later. Kip, you have saved my son twice, and brought me news of his life. You warm an old man's heart. I shall have to reward you properly.
He's my father. No reward is necessary, Kip said.
I insist. Come to my quarters later. Now you're excused,
Andros Guile said. The rest of them just watched as Kip struggled with the dismissal. He didn't want to leave, but he clearly saw no way around it. He bowed after a moment and left. Karis was certain she'd just seen one or the other of them bought off, but she wasn't sure whom. Maybe both. The sheer gall of them to do it in front of the whole spectrum, and the sheer brilliance to be able to get away with it. If it had thrown Andros Guile off, though, he didn't show it.
Well, this is marvellous. There will be some real challenges in getting my son back before anyone else does, but I think we can overcome those difficulties.
As Kip stepped out, Aris Subred came in the door, heavily pregnant and winded.
What are we talking about?
She asked, moving past Karis to her seat. She didn't have her youngest child with her this time, but she did reek of Luxin and sex. Karis was no naif. Everyone knew that greens, reds, and subreds most of all liked to mix drafting and sex. It heightened the sensations and the emotions. Karis didn't care who Aris bedded, but coming to a spectrum meeting sex-flushed and stinking wasn't something Aris would have done when she was in full control of her faculties. A strain of rule kills us all. Karis had thought that Aris had at least 2 years left, but now she wasn't so sure. Subreds tended to get territorial and fiercely, passionately protective of those they loved as they reached the end of their natural spans. And, of course, libidinous. But a woman in Aris's position shouldn't be showing that. Not publicly. Andros pointedly looked at Aris and then ignored her. Dalara Orange said, If the Colour Prince ransoms the prism instead of us, we'll be destroyed. It will utterly cripple morale. They would hold him hostage as guarantee that we wouldn't attack, and then—
No, no, no,
Andros said.
Do you not understand what the sea chariots mean?
Blank looks. Andros smirked. He loved it when his superior intelligence found such undeniable expression.
How is a pirate to hide for long from us? How is he to fight us? We dominate the seas even if no one knows it yet.
If we can dominate the seas, why don't we go after the Colour Prince directly?
Dalara asked.
Because he's on land, Andros said.
I'm not stupid, thank you very much. I mean, if the seas are ours, why not land our men in whatever place is most advantageous? Behind enemy lines, perhaps, and—
Have you even looked at the sea chariots? We'd burn out 1,000 drafters trying to move a single transport ship. We can deny the seas to others. We can search the seas for my son, and with grenadoes and other arms, we can sink the Colour Prince's pirate mercenaries. But until we rebuild our own fleets, our armies can only approach by land.
So they don't really change anything, Clytos Blue said.
Other than assuring that we can't be attacked unawares, and that we will know exactly where the Colour Prince is at all times, weeks before he knows where our armies are, yes, I suppose they change nothing,
Andros said, dripping contempt.
What matters for the moment is that Gavin will be ours before long. We can't guarantee we get him alive, of course, but no one else will get him instead.
And there was the serpent in him. That what he said was true didn't make it any more comforting. The White would have said the same, but she would have spoken to the emotions of the fact first. The thought of losing Gavin through some accident or through some pirate's fury. But then all of what she'd been hearing hit Karius. Gavin was alive. Gavin was alive. The tears of relief blindsided her, and then blinded her. She didn't want to cry in front of Andros Guile, didn't want to show weakness in front of the spectrum, but a single sob escaped her lips. Everyone on the spectrum looked at her, and Karis had to bow her head and clamp her eyes shut to avoid breaking down entirely. She should keep her eyes open. She was a spy now. She should be paying attention. She should be of use.
Alive.
It was hope and light and life and mercy. It was Orholm himself, reaching through the gathering darkness. For once Andros Gael didn't bludgeon Caris for her weakness. Instead, he said,
"Let us all go and send out our scouts and our messages, and report to our satraps about this news. But most of all, let us all pray. For without Orholm's hand, our situation is dire indeed. Let us meet again soon, but for today I think we've seen and said enough. High Lady Palor?"
Let us pray? This was Andros Gael saying this? How shaken was he? The man made a mock of the faith at every chance. The white made the sign of the four and the three, and the rest of the spectrum followed her lead. They lay their hands, palms open, on the table in front of them, receptive, open to the light, open to truth.
"Father of lights, Holy One, Orholm,"
she aspirated the H, giving it the old pronunciation.
"Righteous Father, strong tower of Calon, all-merciful one, comforter of the downtrodden, guardian of orphans, good teacher, deliverer, unfailing defender, saviour, warrior of justice, supreme magistrate, worthy of honour, mighty to save, bright morning star, fire in the night, hope of the last tribe, indefatigable healer, restorer of the broken, father, king, and God."
That last sent a shiver through Caris, even through her tears. Even as Parian men covered their hair from respect, that their glory not compete with Orholm's, so were their ways one rarely addressed Orholm. That name itself was but a title, a euphemism to show supreme deference, to show how high above the pagan gods he was. In speaking that small word, huge in implications, the white was revealing just how dire she thought the situation was.
"God,"
the white breathed. The room fell utterly silent. Caris fancied she could feel the play of light across her face.
"God, you are God alone. God, please save us."
After the long introduction, Caris expected more eloquence, more beseeching, more words. The salutation had been longer than the letter. Then she realized that was the white's point exactly. The eloquence, the focus should be on Orholm. His was the beauty and majesty and the power. He knew their need. He knew how best to help them. This heresy was not only a threat to an earthly order, it was a threat to the worship of Orholm throughout the seven satrapies. It was a defiance and renunciation of him. The white was merely declaring her loyalty and begging the help of their lord as loyal vassals. What else, in the end, was there to say? It was a mirror to the very help that the blood foresters in those border towns would beg, and that the spectrum had silently agreed to deny. "You must die," they had agreed without so much as a vote. "You must die so that our purposes can be accomplished." Caris only hoped Orholm was not so callous and practical with them.